Good evening, everyone. Tonight is going to be a little different than usual. I'm calling this night or this talk a Thursday morning on Monday night, and bringing you some energy and study from the Thursday morning's study group recently, and talking about our most recent endeavor in study, which has been to read Thich Nhat Hanh's translation of the Diamond Sutra. Thich Nhat Hanh translated the Diamond Sutra from the Chinese, not from the original Sanskrit, so it's a little more. It's a slim volume, but I think it captured the essence of the Diamond Sutra quite well. So one of our practices recently has been that when we finish a sutra study, I look in the Book of Serenity, which is a collection of Zen stories, 100 Zen stories that was made in the Song Dynasty in China around the 11th, 12th century. And I look in these stories, and I look for stories that have some relationship or some comment on the sutra, which we've been finding some stories in that regard. And for the Diamond Sutra, we found two. And one is called the Diamond Sutra's Revilement, case number 58. And the other is called Shoshan's Three Phrases. Shoshan's Three Phrases. So this last Thursday, we concluded our study and we concluded a discussion on that latter case. On case is 76 in the book. I thought we would talk about it some more tonight, and I wonder, Kenny, could you go up to the counter there? There are some copies of the first page of this case. And we're going to look at it together. And it's good to have the words in front of you. So this is just the first case, the first page of a quite rich and diverse presentation on this of this case, but the first page has plenty for us tonight. And if you're online, I did put in the announcement that went out today at 3 p.m., I put a link to the entire Book of Serenity. So if you go to your email and see that email that came out today and go to the bottom of the part about that I would be speaking, there's a link and it will go to the Book of Serenity PDF, and you have to scroll through it to find case 76. But it's, you know, it's not too hard to do that. And there's an index at the beginning, so you could find case 76, and it's the same translation that we'll be looking at. You can follow along if you're online as well. So our usual practice in the study group is, of course, when I put paper in front of people, and the first thing they eat, it's like, you know, the phone, you know, it's just, and it's there, you have to look at it. I understand. The practice in the study group is usually to read the sutra or read in this case, the case that's called a public case. That's the name for a Zen story or a koan. It's called a public case. And it's, our practice is to read the case, and then I usually start with some comment, and then open it up, and we have a quite free discussion. Although I do, it's a small group. We have some people online for that as well. And the only rule is that I call on people. So you raise your hand and I say, "Yo, please, you know, Karen or Clem or so on." So, but tonight I'm gonna ask for another rule, which I'm promoting in the study group as well, is that we avoid crosstalk. And what that means in my mind is that if someone offers their explanation or their understanding of something or their question, to remember that not to get engaged one-to-one across the circle with that person, to say, correct their understanding or tell them, you know, what they should be thinking about. So just to remember, you're not each other's teachers, or counselors or educate. You're not educating each other. We're doing this together, and you just speak your own truth, and it will go well. So, so we can start by having someone with the microphone say, "Oscar, would you offer to read the introductory pointer and the case?" And then I'll ask somebody else to read the commentary.
Thank you, Jim. One phrase, the introduction, one phrase illumines three phrases. Three phrases illumine one phrase. One and three have nothing to do with each other. Distinctly clear, the road going beyond. But tell me, which phrase is first? Case. Shaoshan said to the assembly, "If you attain at the first phrase, you will be teacher of Buddhas and patriarchs. If you attain at the second phrase, you will be teacher of humans and gods. If you attain at the third phrase, you cannot even save yourself." A monk asked, "At which phrase did you attain?" Shaoshan said, "The moon sets in night, going through the marketplace."
All right, and I don't know your name.
Lewis.
Lewis, would you like to read the commentary?
The formulation of the three phases began with the Beizhong Huahe, based on the Diamond Cutter Wisdom Scripture. He said, "The words of the teachings all have three successive phases, the beginning, middle, and final good. At first, one should just be taught to produce a good mind. In the middle, the good mind is dissolved. Only the final good is really good. Thus, a bodhisattva is not a bodhisattva. This is called a bodhisattva. And the Dhamma is not Dhamma, nor is it not Dhamma. It's all like this. If you just expound one phrase, you cause sentient beings to go to hell. If all three phrases are expounded at once, sentient beings will go to hell by themselves. This is not the business of a teaching master. To explain that the present mirroring awareness is your own Buddha is good in the beginning. Not to keep dwelling in the present mirror awareness is good in the middle. Not making an understanding of not dwelling is final good." Should I continue?
Yeah, just to the end.
Yunmin once said, "In closing the universe in the heavens, judging grains in ounces at a glance, not involved in the conditions of spring, how do you attain to this? He answered himself, one arrow smashes three barriers.
Thank you. So, you know, these stories are meant to be studied, commented on, and puzzled over. And so I will, as I do in the study group, having had the advantage, except for the people in the study group, of reading this, you know, in advance and puzzling over it, myself, I will make some comments. And then we will open it up to the kind of discussion that, well, just happens. So, first, what is this case about? And it's about three phrases. And, but what those three phrases are, I think, is not just exactly, there are many, many layers of expression about these a different kind of orientation toward these three phrases in the case. I think if we want to narrow it down, we can narrow it down to the statement at the sort of beginning of the commentary that this idea of the three phrases was first brought up by Baizhang, Zen master Baizhang, and he doesn't tell us really what they are, and really nowhere in the case does it explicitly say what these are. But thankfully, if you have this voluminous book, you look in the translator's notes, and he tells you about Baizhang's three phrases refer to. So I will tell you that they refer, according to Thomas Cleary, the translator of this text, they refer to not clinging is the first phrase. Not clinging is the first phrase. The second phrase is not dwelling in not clinging. And the third phrase is not making an understanding of not dwelling in clinging. So that, according to Cleary, is what these three phrases of Baizhang are. But it's also true that the commentary references the Diamond Sutra when it says, Oscar, could you hand me a copy? Because I didn't bring one up here. It's easier to look at the copy than to the... when it says, a bodhisattva is not a bodhisattva. This is called a bodhisattva. The Dharma is not the Dharma, nor is it not Dharma. So this is a direct quote from the Diamond Sutra, and the Diamond Sutra also is based, and the method of the Diamond Sutra is also based on three phrases. One phrase is, in this particular example, is a bodhisattva. That's a phrase. A bodhisattva. There's an assertion. There's a bodhisattva. And the second phrase is a bodhisattva, not a bodhisattva. And the third phrase is, and therefore, this is called a bodhisattva. So those three, there's three phrases there. And Thich Nhat Hanh calls this this methodology of the Diamond Sutra, he calls this the dialectic of Prajnaparamita, the dialectic of Prajnaparamita. And Prajnaparamita, basically that dialectic is A is not A, therefore it is A. That's the dialectic of the Prajnaparamita. There's an assertion, there's a denial of that assertion, and then there's a reassertion of the original assertion. So assertion, denial, assertion. And that is the dialectic of the Diamond Sutra. So on the one hand, what you can say is that the Diamond Sutra, and in a sense, the whole Prajnaparamita presentation, perfection it means perfection of wisdom. But it's most clear in the Diamond Sutra that this is Buddhist skepticism. In other words, it's Buddhist skepticism in the sense that the way that we perceive and name things and characterize things, we have on the one hand a belief that that represents an accurate picture of reality, that our perception of everything is the way things really are. And what the Diamond Sutra is teaching and Prajnaparamita is teaching is be careful about that. Be careful about an understanding that's based on perception. That perception, as is sometimes cutely said, is deception. Perception is deception. And that the way that things appear to our senses is a kind of, it's kind of a gross level, of understanding of things. And that there's a deeper level that's called dependent origination or interdependent origination. And that is that everything is that appears is appearing based on causes and conditions that are other than itself, that are other than itself. And that so that nothing has its an essence, right? And so this is familiar, I think, to you, probably almost all of you, in terms of your Buddhist studies. And so the Diamond Sutra is bringing this out. This is where this original teaching comes. That we have misplaced our faith in perception. And that we need to look deeper. We need to look deeper into the nature of reality. And of course, this is what our practice is meant to help us with, meant to help us look deeper. So the sutra says, it's trying to, first of all, correct our habit of relying on perception and trusting perception. Perception is not to be trusted. And the sutra says, when a bodhisattva gives rise to the unequaled mind of awakening, he has to give up all perceptions. He cannot rely on forms when he gives rise to that mind, nor sounds, smells, tastes, tactile objects, or objects of mind. He can only give rise to that mind that is not caught up in anything.
You're reading from the Diamond Sutra?
I'm reading from the Diamond Sutra. I'm reading from Thich Nhat Hanh's translation of the Diamond Sutra. I'll read it again. When a bodhisattva gives rise to the unequaled mind of awakening, he has to give up all perceptions. He cannot rely on forms when he gives rise to that mind, nor sounds, smells, tastes, tactile objects, or objects of mind. He can only give rise to that mind which is not caught up in anything. So that should be very familiar also. We just chanted it, did we not, tonight? No eyes, no ears, no tongue, no body, no form, no feeling, no perception, no, and so forth. But luckily, so this is sort of the this is the part of the Diamond Sutra that says a bodhisattva is not a bodhisattva, or a dharma is not a dharma. But luckily, the analysis does not stop there for us, because otherwise we would fall into nihilism. We would think that nothing has any substantial basis, and there's no hope of us ever getting out of that situation. But the Diamond Sutra, it doesn't stop its analysis there. It doesn't stop at questioning the conventional perceptual constructed world. The sutra says, and very helpfully, this is very helpful to understanding the last part, why it's called a bodhisattva, why it's called a dharma. The sutra says, Subhuti, if you think that the Tathagata realizes the highest, most fulfilled, awakened mind, which of course we think the Tathagata realizes that, right? If you think that the Tathagata realizes the highest, most awakened mind and does not need to know the names and characteristics of things, you are wrong. Subhuti, do not think that way. Do not think that when one gives rise to the highest, most fulfilled, awakened mind, one needs to see all objects of mind as non-existent, cut off from life. Please do not think that way. One who gives rise to the highest, most fulfilled, awakened mind does not contend that all objects of mind are non-existent and cut off from life. So we can't stop at a bodhisattva is not a bodhisattva. It's a very important teaching, that, and that's the teaching of form is emptiness, right? That's the teaching of form is emptiness. A bodhisattva is not a bodhisattva. A bodhisattva is made up of non-bodhisattva elements. A dharma is made up of all the things that it is not. Form is emptiness. But we have to come back, and we have to complete the phrase, emptiness is form. There has to be a return. There has to be a return from emptiness. Otherwise, if there wasn't a return from emptiness, the Buddha would never have taught, would never have said anything, would not have been able to say anything. He would have just stayed in emptiness. And, you know, sometimes there's criticism in Buddhism of people who, like, just kind of go over and just stay in the emptiness side. But this practice of the middle way recommends coming back, certainly cleansed and purified by that first analysis, but coming back, as it says in the phrase, to the marketplace, to the marketplace. So in this wonderful presentation, what did I do with my presentation? Oh, here. In this wonderful first page of this case, which is really the clearest part of this case, because it really gets very hard, much harder than this as you read on. But this part is pretty clear. I found, at least in this part, at least five examples of three phrases. He has one. He has a whole pile of them, actually. I did take it from him, but he grabbed another one. Yeah, he had extra. So I don't know if I should talk about say any more about these examples, or we should just open it up. What would you prefer? Are there comments at this point? We have study group people who are here who may have already formed some words about this these three phrases. Are they unitary? Are they different? These three in this presentation, because there's various ways that it's presented here. Yes.
In response to your question, I would say they're different because they're unitary. But my comment was that first of all, thank you for this explication. And I wanted to report that Uchiyama, in his opening the hand of thought, in his translation, refers back to the Nikayas for this teaching. And I actually looked it up, and it's in at least two Nikayas, this thought, the Buddha's thought, which in Uchiyama's translation is, to believe that all things exist is one extreme. To believe that nothing exists is another extreme. Apart from these two extremes, separate. The Tathagata teaches, because this arises, that arises, because this exists, that exists. And then Nikaya refers to the 12-fold path, but to the
Eightfold path, to the middle way,
to the 12-fold
chain of causation.
Chain of causation. Mm-hmm. And Uchiyama just says cause and effect.
Mm-hmm.
So this really is delightful in tying that together, and hinting at how those three phrases that Buddha is said to have uttered have, you know, bounced through the ages in these different formulations. Well, thank you very much.
So one phrase, one way that this is... Oh, there's Dave. Okay, go ahead.
So, bear with me. I'm still trying to figure out what I'm saying. I think Okamura, I think, did a commentary on the Heart Sutra in one of his books, I think.
Probably.
It was either him or Uchiyama. And he was saying that the understanding that form and formlessness are the same thing is like the understanding to try to understand. And I remember when we had Ben Connolly on Zoom a few years ago. I remember, you know, he talked about the three realities of Buddhism. And I think, well, I know there's two. There's the ordinary and the ultimate. And help me out, someone who else was there and might remember better. But he said, you know, the third is the understanding of both.
I don't remember. I was there, but it's been a few years. I'm sorry, I can't.
Oh, that's
you.
A,
but what Ben Connolly
but that
said.
Seems but that seems to be the what they're driving at here is the understanding of both or something.
Thank you.
I just want to share something that was also from. From a from Thich Nhat Hanh that really helped me, and it was it might even be in the same book in which Avalokiteshvara says that all things are empty, and then he asks Avalokita, what are they empty of? And he says they are only empty of one thing. They are only empty of inherent existence, and otherwise they are full of everything. And I think that clarifies a lot of what emptiness really means. Empty of inherent existence, not the negation of anything, but rather we're only minus one thing, inherent existence, and otherwise, because of dependent arising, we are full of everything in the universe.
Thank you. Well, I'll just comment on what I find the most clear and wonderful presentation of the three phrases in this piece, which is at the end of the paragraph on the commentary. It says, to explain that the present mirroring awareness is your own Buddha is good in the beginning. Not to keep dwelling in the present mirror awareness is good in the middle. Not to make an understanding of not dwelling is the final good. So that very much accords, first of all, with the presentation that I read about what Cleary said that these three phrases refer to, not clinging, not dwelling and not clinging, and not making an understanding of not dwelling. So this accords quite nicely, and we, I think, must understand it as a comment on Baijiang's three phrases then, if Cleary is correct, about his understanding of what Baijiang's three phrases are. But in terms of practice, this statement to explain that the present mirroring awareness is your own Buddha is a very good practice instruction, right? And the image of a mirror comes up quite a bit in our various texts and poems and so forth. And the quality of a mirror is that nothing sticks or clings to a mirror. No image will stay in a mirror. It only reflects what is in front of it. And when that object moves away, the mirror is clear again. So this is really a very good practice, instruction in terms of how to understand your mind. And relate to your mind as a mirror to which nothing can cling, and that is a reality of mind. Now there's also consciousness, and consciousness is dependent on subject and object. It's dependent on a subject and an object. So this mind that it's talking about is different than consciousness. It's not the same thing. It's the mind of Zazen. And the mind of Zazen just is like a mirror, and things are passing, and things are passing in front of it. Things are passing in front of this mind, thoughts are passing in front of this mind, feelings are passing in front of this mind. But the reality of this mind is that nothing can stick to it. Nothing can stay. Nothing can cling. So this first phrase is, you know, really saying, you know, Baizhang's first phrase is this quality, this truth of not clinging, and not being clung to by anything. So in terms of, you know, understanding your, what you're up to, if you're up to anything at all in Zazen, is to appreciate, you know, this quality of mind that doesn't get involved and that doesn't have any clinging. It's free of clinging. It's free of clinging. But then it's, you know, he does say this is not like the goal or something like that. You know, this is not the goal to just understand yourself as a mirror or your mind as a mirror, because then you could start, you know, dwelling in that understanding. And so we're to understand that and not dwell in that and not cling to that either. And then not even make an understanding of that. So this is the practice of an adept, really. This isn't a practice of an adept, someone who's really let go, really let go. But that image, I find it extremely helpful as a way to orient myself in Zazen. How to point myself and not, you know, encouragement not to get involved in the things that come before the mind, essentially. Not to get involved, not to lose ourselves in the objects that are in front of the mind, but to engage with the mind itself that doesn't have any clinging. Clem.
Yeah, I could say something to that. My experience is that the not clinging mind, it's easier said than done. I know when I first showed up here, I had very many thoughts that I clung to. And I would encourage anyone, don't be discouraged. It takes time.
Well, you have to make some effort, you know. It's true. You have to make some effort. Let's see. You've spoken, so I just want to see if there's anybody else. Okay, Oscar. Were you? I don't know. Was it
no.
you?
No.
Thank you very much, Glenn.
A more prosaic way of looking at it that I find helpful is that you know, reality is not dual. That's just, you know, physical, literal physical reality. Nothing is separated from anything else. You know, every science, this is what every science is about, the relationship of things. But it seems like our mind is hardwired to discriminate, where there is no actual discrimination, to discriminate, because otherwise, you know, we couldn't survive. Life couldn't have evolved without the tendency to make distinctions between self and other, subject and object, good and bad, dangerous and beneficial. So we have this inbred, not only Our mind is wired in such a way as to discriminate and find discriminations. And that's real. That's reality. That is our reality. But it's not ultimate reality. And opening up to the psychological reality is opens us up to the greater reality. I mean, not just saying it the way I am, but actually perceiving it.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that it says, I thank you, and I agree with everything you said. And it just reminded me, when you were talking, reminded me to say that it says that the present mirroring awareness is your own Buddha. This is because Buddha is here, you know, is here demonstrate, you know, liberative technique. You know, that's Buddhas are here to demonstrate liberative technique. So we're in the situation that Oscar described. That is the situation. discriminating consciousness is here, and that is our reality. And we've learned that it is not Buddha's reality. Buddha's reality is not discriminating consciousness. Buddhas are they have a unique capacity because they are the beings who can actually see dependent origination, interdependent origination. They can actually see it. They don't do what all the rest of us do. But if we have a Buddha, it's good to have a Buddha in your life. And this is what it's saying: the present mirroring awareness is your own Buddha. So that's really encouraging that you have some opportunity to join with this great Buddha principle of interdependent origination. You have that possibility of getting a glimpse of that, and this can be a very encouraging and very helpful when things aren't going too well, you know, or when things are going well. Totally.
Picking up on that same group of sentences there, we have to find it again. To explain that the present mirroring awareness is your own Buddha, and then not to keep dwelling in the present mirror awareness is good. I just want to emphasize the word awareness, because I think really, at least this is my understanding, that it's the awareness itself that releases you from it. But it's tendency that once we're aware, then we think we should be doing something with it. Mm. But actually, it's the awareness itself, and that's much simpler because you're sort of living in the awareness, and that keeps you free to go and to not dwell not to dwell, to both be present in the mirror, not to dwell in the mirror, and then at the same time to let go of needing to understand the not dwelling. All of that, if it's just held within awareness itself, moves it through the moon and the midnight and going into the marketplace. That's what I wanted to say. Thank you. Sarah.
This may seem totally off the wall, but it's what came up for me as we were reading the case, is our current political discourse of the denial of what some people say are facts. You know, the election was stolen, vaccines don't work, all this denial, the climate change is not real. And what came to me, because it is a very personal thing, I have a cousin that I love dearly who lives up in Yuba City, and climate change is not real. That's her assertion to me. And, you know, it's not real. It's that people are making it up. It's just normal variations. And initially, my response to her was to send her information, right? Give her the facts and she'll come around to it. No, that was not her reality at all. And the more information that I provided her, I could feel the barriers coming up between us as we were doing that. And so I was thinking about, you know, what is her reality, trying to look into that, and with love, because I love her dearly. And then I started seeing other things. They installed solar panels on their house. So there's another reality that was going on there. And then I was looking at and thinking, you know, I think what was going on with her was fear. Really deep down, I think she was feeling fear and threatened at the increasingly hot summers and the cost of her electricity that she was experiencing. And once I came to that realization or insight, our dialogue has totally changed about, you know, and it shifted. So it's that, to me, this dialectic of, you know, A is A is not A, but A is A, is that trend, that's those steps that went through looking into her assertion that it's not, and then looking into where her assertion that it's not really was, and then to where our relationship has now changed. So, and I've changed too in that process. I've left this in the mirror. My initial face was, you're wrong. You know, you're not seeing reality as it is. That was my initial face. But I left that mirror, and now I'm not in it. And I think maybe that's part of going into the marketplace with these koans, is how actually do they play out in our dialogue and our interaction with people around issues, you know, that are pretty, very, very serious and have caused huge divisions in our country and also in families. Thank you.
Well, I did want to say something. I guess I'd want to say something. You know, there is comment in the further parts of the case about what Shoshan says about if you attain at the first phrase, you will be the teacher of Buddhas and patriarchs and so forth. But I won't go into that really. But he does say, if you attain at the third phrase, you cannot even save yourself. That's to be understood as the really completed bodhisattva, because the really completed bodhisattva isn't interested in saving themselves. They have actually forsworn saving themselves. So it's not a negative, as I understand it. And then I've puzzled over this moon sets. Midnight, going through the marketplace, but I see it in the dialectic of the Prajnaparamita as there's an assertion, moon. There's a moon, and then it sets. There's no moon. There's no moon. There's a moon, and no moon. So there's an assertion of something, and there's an assertion of not there, and then the going through the marketplace is, you know, the bodhisattva having thoroughly studied form and emptiness enters the marketplace with open hands and helping hands. That's the way I understand. That's what I've come to in terms of study, thinking about this phrase and this presentation. So I think that what Sean is saying is that he's attained all these three phrases. He's attained at all of them, and you know, or he's experienced it all. So he experienced samsara in his life. He experienced emptiness, or experienced nirvana, and you know, he's committed himself to engaging in bodhisattva activity in the world. So could relate, you know, to your in some cases it's better not to get involved in assertion and denial, but just go straight to the marketplace and see how you can help. And it's not always easy to do that, but nevertheless, it's really actually, you know, it's really important to do the emptiness part. It's really important to do that part, to just let go of everything for a while. And that's why we go on retreat, and that's why we need that. We actually need that in our life. We need that letting go of everything part, that complete dropping it all. It's so enriching, you know, for our life to do that, that kind of practice, and then, you know, return and refreshed. Karen. I don't have a watch, by the way, so correct me if I'm... Okay, we're coming to the end.
I was just thinking of that word refreshed. But I was comparing what it's saying here, I mean, the three phases, I guess, or phrases. anyway, I'm thinking of it in terms of... If the mind is a mirror and our perception is a mirror, but then ironically, like if I really stop and really, really look and experience, say, a tree, then and draw the tree, say, after a while, it stops being a tree. And then... I guess that's what I want to say. And then once I stop concentrating or focusing on it, then I feel refreshed. So I guess that goes along with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you're drawing the tree and you're really drawing the tree, you forget yourself, right?
True.
You forget mm-hmm. the self. So that's mm-hmm. another, mm-hmm. you know, that's another dialectic. That's another one of... We have that dialectic. To study Buddhism is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. Mm-hmm. To forget the self is to be awakened by all things. There's another three phrases, you know. So these three phrases are around the garden here. So anyway, if you want to look online and you can see the rest of this case, which is doesn't get any easier, but there's a poem, and I did want to say, I guess I do want to say about this Yunmin at the end, and then I'll stop. Yunmin once said, "In closing the universe in the heavens, judging grams and ounces at a glance, not involved in the conditions of spring, how do you attain to this? He answered himself, one arrow smashes three barriers. I think that the one arrow is our practice. One arrow is zazen. One arrow is whatever the three barriers are, whatever they are. It's our one-pointed devotion and engagement in practice that smashes barriers. And, you know, when barriers are smashed, we're free, right? So I just want to emphasize, you know, this is what Zen people always emphasize is practice. Practice. Practice is the one arrow that frees us. One arrow that clears the barriers. Thank you very much.